Open Source relies on listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The UN scientists are trying to scare us about the climate, but first they're trying to wake us up in case you slipped through Hurricane Michael in Florida this week. The wildfires, the sheared off glaciers, the crazy weather all the time now. From the steady rise in the Earth's temperature and the damage it does, scientists from 100 nations conclude that the voluntary goals agreed at Paris to hold a long warming trend under 2 degrees centigrade will not save us. Capturing carbon will be a technological feat, but tech will not be enough, they say. Planet Earth will still need to redesign land use and energy, transportation and industry, a makeover on a scale with no precedent. So we must think anew and act anew, as Lincoln said. We get started this hour with the most honored scientist in England, the astrophysicist and royal astronomer Martin Rees, who has put the chance of human survival past this 21st century at about 50-50. On a planet that's been floating out there for 45 million centuries, the risk, he says, is that you and I and he are living in the very last one.
This is the first century when one species, namely the human species, has the power to determine the planet's future. And if we screw up badly, then indeed there will be a disastrous ecology we will leave for future centuries. On the other hand, it's the technology which we have, which could allow us to get through this century and lead to a better life at the end of it.
People today all live with the sense that, you know, this might just be the end, really the end. What's it like to be dwelling in that mystery?
Well, I describe myself as being a technical optimist, but a political pessimist. We have the technology already, which could allow a better life for the 7 billion people on this planet. And we have potential of much better technology to provide much more food, to provide cleaner energy, etc., by the middle of a century. But of course, there's a big gap between the way the world could be and the way the world is. And that's an indictment of our politicians and of our ethics.
What's the technology that could save us?
If we're thinking about climate, the IPCC report is suggesting that we really need to aim at a more drastic target, which involves a transition from our carbon-dependent economy now to one where we, in effect, produce zero carbon. And this is a very big challenge. And, of course, one has to ask, first, is this necessary? And secondly, is it feasible? I think it's necessary if we want to avoid the risk of something really bad by the end of a century, because the climate projections are a bit uncertain. But, of course, the worst case is very, very serious indeed. It will lead to tipping points and the melting of Greenland's ice cap, etc. So we want to avoid that. And this new report, which is based on better science than the previous one, does suggest that we've got to start now and make a big transformation in the next 15 years or so. The only realistic win-win situation, which is a way in which we could have a transition to a carbon-free world, would be if we can accelerate research and development into all forms of clean energy and into the ancillaries like batteries and smart grids, etc., that we need to go with that system. If we can do that, and if that brings the cost down, then people won't need to be pressured into using clean energy. They will choose to use clean energy. And in particular, India will, because in India, they now get their energy from smoky stoves in their homes, burning wood and dung, very unhealthy, and they need a major grid if they are to develop. And what they're going to do, if nothing changes, is to build coal-fired power stations, getting cheap coal from Australia, probably. What we want to do is to see if we could accelerate R&D so that clean energy, whether it's solar or anything else, is as cheap as coal, so that countries like India can leapfrog directly to clean energy. If that happens, then it's not crazy to think we could meet those targets.
In your wonderful, small, readable book on the future, Martin Rees, you seem to bet that things will get worse before they get better, that
human beings will not enforce the Paris Accord 1.5 degrees growth, at least for 20 years, and they won't even get around to it then unless a present disaster puts us in panic mode, plan B mode, and then we have to develop carbon capture technology.
I think that is indeed at present the most likely scenario, but I think the way we can avoid that scenario and get more urgent action to reduce emissions in the short term is if there is public pressure, because one of the difficulties is that this action is short term on a geological timescale, but very long term by the standards of politicians. And that's why it's an unpopular ask to ask politicians to implement procedures and constraints and taxes which are going to cause a rapid cut in fossil fuel emissions for the benefit of future generations and people in distant parts of the world.
That is a great paradox still. You ask the question in your book, why do governments respond with torpor?
That's right.
To the climate crisis?
The reason is that there's no public pressure. In fact, I would quote a distinguished European politician, Jean-Claude Juncker, who said in a different context, the politicians know what they should do, but they don't know how to get re-elected when they do it. And that's a big dilemma for politicians. And I think the answer is that politicians do respond to public pressure. They respond to what's in the press. They respond to what's in their inboxes. And the trouble is that these issues are as yet not very much in the public debate. They were after the at the time of the Paris conference. In fact, one of the most important interventions was from the Pope in the middle of 2015 when he put out an encyclical which urged the importance of conserving the environment and reducing climate change. And the Pope got a 5-minute standing ovation at the UN. He had a big reception, not in the United States, but in Latin America, in Africa and in East Asia, where his million followers took note of what he said, as did their political leaders. And that intervention made a big difference to the ease with which a consensus was reached at the Paris Convention on Climate Change in December 2015. That was an example. And we've got to hope that there will be other people who will campaign very loudly for this issue to rise up the agenda. Talk about scientists. I know many scientists who've been advisors to politicians, and their effect is limited because politicians tend to have an urgent agenda to focus on. But that is why the most effective action comes through mass movements. If we think of what's happened in the United States, issues like black power and gay rights, for instance, they rose up the agenda because there was a campaign. And if we had people like Carl Sagan and Rachel Carson and people like that, who were able, by their eloquence and their books, that makes a difference. But I think if I speak as an astronomer,
please,
the astronomers are aware not only that the Earth has been around for 45 centuries and it is a special one, but also that the future is equally long. We are not the culmination of evolution. We may be an important transition stage. That therefore means that we ought to be especially careful because we could, by our actions this century, not only make life worse for our grandchildren, those alive at the end of the century, but also for many centuries ahead. And we ought to realize that just one century is a blink of an eye in the cosmic context.
You're quoting some of the great humane voices in our world of all time, maybe, and yet the world depends more on extraction today than it ever did. We're burning more coal and oil, and we're emitting more carbon to the atmosphere than before. How do we square this contradiction?
Well, I think it's not a contradiction. I think the growth in the consumption of fossil fuels is a consequence of a good thing, which is namely the rise in the standard of living in many developing countries, above all in China and in certain other countries where there's been rapid development. So I think the point is that the worst emissions are in the United States, about 20 tons per person per year. And no other country is up at that level, apart from a few Gulf states. But the gap is closing as countries like China develop. I think In China, it's about 4 or 5 tons per year per person now. And so the rise is due to many more people rising out of poverty. So we shouldn't be too critical of that. But clearly, we have to do something about it. It can't be the case that all developing countries follow the same track as those that we did in this country and in Europe since the Industrial Revolution. All countries have to leapfrog towards clean energy, and that is why we need more technology. And also, it's not just climate change and sea levels and all that. It's the consequence of that in moving global weather patterns and causing mass migration and mass extinctions. E.O. Wilson said that if our actions cause mass extinctions, it's the sin that future generations will least forgive us for.
Can I share my sort of secret fear here?
Please.
It's that climate degradation will not kill the planet or the species, but it will make human life a great deal more unequal, nastier, more brutal, and a great deal uglier, and that we will have lost some of the most wonderful things we think of as human.
Well, I think that is true. It'll lead to that, and it'll have a particular effect in countries which are now disadvantaged, parts of Africa, etc., by moving the regions of droughts and affecting the monsoons in Asia and all that. So it's not going to kill us all off, but it is going to cause the planet, what the Pope would say was our creation, to be in a degraded state. And I speak from Europe, where we are aware of how much we owe to future generations and future centuries in the beautiful artifacts and buildings and infrastructure of our country. It would be sad if what we pass on to future centuries is a degraded world. It would be shameful if, given our far greater resources, we didn't leave positive heritage, but left this negative heritage for future generations.
It won't just be Bangladesh either, or India. It'll be also the sceptered isle of England.
Indeed it will. Of course, Bangladesh will be more hard hit and is less able to cope, but it will be the sceptered isle of England and even the great city on a hill which you have in the United States.
Martin Rees, such a pleasure to hear you again. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very good to be talking with you.
Martin Rees's new book is On the Future. You probably have time to get it from the library, and you can read it in an evening. Coming up, an agonizing reappraisal of our chances from inside the UN climate team that won the Nobel Peace Prize a decade ago. This is Open Source. The United Nations climate panel that went nearly red alert this week has issued gentler warnings for most of its 30-year history. Our guest, Adil Najam, was the lead author of two earlier assessments. He wrote the stuff that amounted to the Nobel Peace Prize and won the prize in 2007. Professor Najam is now Dean of Boston University's School of Global Studies. Welcome back, Professor Najam. What's the lesson of your long history in this game? And what's the inside line on this report?
I think it's an important report, but it's not a surprising report. And the surprise is how we keep getting surprised about the same thing again and again and again. I don't think it's a more frightening report than previous ones. As your intro said, we've been sleeping. So we haven't been hearing what the IPCC has been saying. We haven't been hearing what nature has been telling us all around us, not just in Florida, all over South Asia, all over Southeast Asia, all over Europe. And so in some ways, you know, it's like the same thing gets repeated again and again and again.
But what's new in these cascading feedback loops, for example?
So I think what's new here is this 1.5 degree sort of, which has become the new scare target that after which the world is going to somehow become irreversibly different. My point is that the world is already irreversibly different, that for hundreds of millions of people in the world, the poorest people in the world, some of the poorest people in the world, climate change is not something you talk about the future tense. Climate change is something that is here, that is happening now. And my issue with the report, if any, is that it's maybe not frightening enough. It's trying to frighten us about the future, without really fully telling us about the present. I can see why they are doing it, because they want to spur us, right, mostly you and me, people who are affluent, into action. And this is one more attempt at saying, hey, oh God, please do something and do it now. I think that's a good message. But there's another message, and the message is that climate change is happening now. It's happening in Bangladesh. It's happening in Pakistan. It's happening in Haiti. It's happening in Mauritius. It's happening in Vanuatu. And it's happening, and this is the key point, it is happening it is happening with gravest consequences in places which had the least to do with causing the problem. So those who had least to do with making the mess are at the forefront of having to deal with it. That is why I think climate is a justice issue. And this report, as well as previous IPCC reports, I don't think have done justice to climate as a justice issue.
Yeah, we can't get ahead around so many aspects, but stick with justice. What are the blocks in our understanding, or just our humanity, that don't see Bangladesh as the eye of this storm, say? Many other places.
I think it is the humanity that is at test here. I think at test here is not science, right? We IPCC keeps coming up with one report, and I'm a fan of IPCC. I've been part of it. But this is no longer a question of science. The big challenge is not whether we have enough science or not. The big challenge is whether we have enough action or not. And why is that not happening? That is a question of our humanity, as you put it, i.e. of ethics, and whether we as a species are fully evolved to look at ourselves and our survival as a species, and I'm not sure we are. And the second thing is, I think there is enough technology, there is enough science, there is enough knowledge for us to make a difference. I am not convinced anymore that there is enough wisdom in our species to act in time and to act for the benefit of the entire species. If I can say something rather harsh, with your permission, I think in some ways, all of us who say we take climate change seriously do not actually take it seriously enough, because we've all figured out that we probably will swim. It's kind of like a boat that was about to go down. We all thought we'll go down with it. And now suddenly we realize, maybe not. Maybe some of us will make it to the other side. And at that point, your challenge is, are you going to lend a hand to those who will go down? And the fact of the matter is, we have not been doing that.
You know, politicians take a lot of heat, and they should, for being unwilling to risk their jobs. But, I mean, every one of us, I think, is afraid that doing something serious would risk our own jobs.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I think that is, we have kind of made the bet that somehow the gods of technology and the gods of the free market will somehow find a solution in time for us to be saved. And maybe we are right. But the problem is that not all of us will be saved. And as I said, it is those who had least to do with causing the mess that are having to face the consequences.
There are limits here on our humanity, and shame on us. But there's also years and years in a long life, but of conditioning. We are told over and over again that it's great to be rich. Anybody can strive for it. The degrees of mechanization, but of privilege, of leisure, of fun that we have defined as human, would be very hard to give up at this point.
Yes, and frankly, you know, when I say that, you know, it's a question of justice, here's the thing. Why does nature target the poor? What does nature have against the poorest people in the world? The fact of the matter is that if you are poor, you will end up living in the most vulnerable places. And if you are the poorest, living in the most vulnerable places, it is most likely that you do not have the ability to deal with those disasters when they come. So the disaster comes to Florida and the disaster comes to Karachi or Mumbai. But if you are on the edge in Mumbai, you are much less likely to have the resources to deal with it. And the point I'm making about, you know, this is no longer a future issue, this report, and we still talk about climate as if it's something far in the distance. Or maybe not that far in the distance, but still something in the future. But across the world, it is not a future issue. Look at the heat waves going around South Asia. Look at floods, my country, Pakistan. There is now, for the last 6-7 years, a continuous flood. Every year there is a flood with number of deaths. At the same time, there are droughts. At the same time, there are heat waves taking more lives in Karachi this summer. At that time, more people died in the heat wave than through terrorism in the entire year.
My word. Right?
And this is a violent place anyhow. So the point I'm making is that nature is telling us that the normal, the new normal, is a climatically changed normal for a lot of places. And who is paying the price? It is the poorest, those who are least able to do something about this, those who were least responsible for causing the mess.
And we still talk down to the poor. And the great minds of the West, including that wonderful man, Martin Rees, are going to tell the world how to deal with the problem that we in the West created. I mean, so many sort of, we meet ourselves coming and going. The West produced the Industrial Revolution that created the problem and divided the world. And still somehow we expect that those geniuses that we all know and love are going to solve this problem. Maybe you can tell us, though, what do the light footprint people of the world in Pakistan, in Africa, in China, have to offer this conversation that we're not hearing?
They do have to offer an idea of an ideal of a life that is not as driven by the ideal of growth as our model is. But here is the thing that we should also be concerned about. The light footprint people, as you put it, are seeing the same world you and I are. And they're saying that these heavy footprint people are taking too many resources away from me, and maybe I need to be in the same place. Right? So what Lord Martin Rees was exactly right on is you cannot point a finger to the poorest people of the world and say, why do you want to drive a car? Why do you want to use a fridge? Right? If we are not able to change our lifestyle, we cannot arrogantly tell the poorest of the world, you know, we are used to being rich, so we have to live like this, but you must save the planet for our future generation. That cannot work, and it's evident that it is not working.
Adil Najam, I want you to review your own history in this battle. You go back to Rio in 1992, President George H.W. Bush, yes. One of his better weekends, and maybe the last moment of sort of reassurance that we could think our way out of this box.
You know, Rio 1992 was a turning point for many of us, including myself. I was young. I was idealistic. We thought we could change the world. And here are two things that I remember from that. One, what you are probably referring to, this possibly the most honest statement made by any politician ever about climate change.
Let's hear it.
George Bush comes to Rio and says, and I quote, "The American lifestyle is not open to negotiation." And this wasn't just George Bush. This is not about Trump. Everyone in between, you and me included, have essentially said, we want to care about climate, but not so much that it starts messing with my life.
Barack Obama said something very much like it, and it gave me pause in his inaugural address. He said, we are not going to apologize for our way of life.
And again, I don't think the world needs an apology. And this, by the way, I should also say, this is not just about the U.S. This is about the rich, even in poor countries. So the rich in my own country, Pakistan, are more wasteful, are more excessive. Right? So this is not about good country, bad country. This is about
the well-off in Pakistan.
Yes. So the point I'm making is that we as a species kind of made the bet that we were going to wait for technology to come and solve it. We were going to wait for solutions to be found. Mm. And we are affluent enough and well off enough that we can wait it out. And that's probably true. And that's the justice argument, because many others are not. A lot of good things have happened in technology. At Rio, I would probably not have thought that a quarter century later, we would be talking about climate with the urgency that you and I are talking about today.
What did you think?
I thought we would lick the problem. I thought we were a smart species. I thought we were a species. You know, the Cold War had just ended. Mm-hmm. There was possibility. Jane Fonda was there, for God's sake. Right? I thought we would get together, the world would come to its senses, and we would find the resources and the wisdom to lick the problem. And now, after a quarter century of talking, we have done a lot of good things, yes. So I don't want to paint a totally false picture because, for example, I would also not have thought that the energy transition that is now inevitable would have happened this way. For example, I do think coal is dead. I do think renewables are going to be the way that my children will organize their life. I also think that it will come too late. And without honest changes in lifestyle, we cannot sustain a planet of 7.5 billion, now 10 billion in a few decades.
I talk lifestyle. I cannot believe that NPR listeners giving up steak is going to make a big difference, even spiritually. But what might in lifestyle? I don't have a car anymore, if that helps.
So I think a lot of people have made choices, including myself. You know, I'm very proud to drive a Prius. But we also, when we make one good choice, we also make all these other choices that we choose not to make, right? Which is also a choice. So by lifestyle, I think it is realizing the limits of the planet. It's realizing that my consumption is not only my consumption, it is taking away from someone else's ability to consume, right? The finiteness of the planet, of its resources, is what that consumptive lifestyle is. Hmm. I do think that even most of us still think of the planet as infinite.
You know, again, that's trained into us. Also, the technological fix is built into us. My man, Ralph Waldo Emerson, among his many great aphorisms, said, invent a better mousetrap and the world will beat a path to your door. In other words, technology builds profit and improvement for everybody. And we, I don't know, how do we escape thinking that?
I not just escape, I think we live in a particular moment of techno-optimism. Going back again to 1992, most of us who were thinking about climate and environment had come to think at that point that technology was not going to be the answer. It was going to be part of the answer. But technology alone would not do it without lifestyle change. I think at this point, the bet is that Tesla is going to save the world.
Tesla, before its troubles, before Elon Musk fell off the cliff himself?
Despite what's happening to it. But the bet is that somehow these better mousetraps, and you know, there's a lot of wonderful technology that has happened, but in some ways everyone is making the bet that technology is going to come to the rescue in time. And what I keep harping on, it well may for you and me, but for hundreds of millions of people, it is already too late. Climate change is happening now for them, and technology won't be able to save them.
I think Tesla is the wrong example because it's not just Elon Musk's child, but it's so conspicuously
flashy,
wasteful, over the top. Who needs that kind of car, really? But would you say your students believe in techno fixes?
So, as you didn't maybe growing up? I talk about this to my students all the time. One of the big changes is when I was where they are now in that classroom, we did not have the faith in technology that my current students do. We also did not have the faith in business as the solution that current students do. It's a question of where they are in time. But we do live in a moment of techno-optimism, right? We take out this little thing from our pocket called the smartphone, and it's supposed to be smart because someone said it was. And we think there'll be a button one day and it'll say climate change, go away. And it will go away. I'm being facetious here, but the more serious point is that technology is a central part of the solution. But there is no model, IPCC or anywhere else, that is telling you that technology alone can lick the problem. More importantly, lick it in time.
Go back to your own personal story. In you said 1992, you were ready to go home and declare victory. When was the turnaround moment when you said, uh-oh?
Yeah. I don't think we were ready to declare victory, but we were ready for a fight, right? This was the great global challenge that would bring the world together. And together this planet could solve this problem. That was the optimism, not just in me, but in many. With the IPCC, for example, you know, by the time, by about 10 years ago, my thought was that IPCC, which was set up for the following cause, right? Here is the reason IPCC was set up, to tell politicians about the state of the science of climate change. At least 10 years ago, the IPCC, I had thought, should have said, we are going to close shop and declare victory. We have done what we were told to do. We were told to tell the policymakers what the science says. We've done that. And now we should step back and we'll continue doing our science, but they should do policy. At this point, I think IPCC should go even bolder, declare victory, close shop, and then declare defeat. And by defeat, I mean essentially saying we weren't able to convince the policymakers. The policymakers have used science rather than the other way around. They just sort of keep asking for more science as if one more report is going to do something, but the doing has to be done by governments, by cities, by corporations, by citizens, by consumers.
What would it take to convince us that rearranging entirely the whole world's economic and resource and social systems has to take at least a century? That it's a desperately necessary, difficult, and maybe with 100, you know, tech miracles, can be done.
Yeah. It can be done, and I'm more optimistic than you, Chris, on that one. I think it can be done faster, but I see no intent to do it faster because, as I said, I think the ugly truth is a lot of us have realized that we can swim out of this one. So if I can swim out of this one, why am I going to give a hand to someone else?
We're talking about the UN's 22-year warning. Time is running out to do something about a miserable climate future. Coming up from the rising generation of climate warriors, the writer Ajay Singh Chaudhary. This is Open Source. In the ever-energetic N+1 magazine online, one article yesterday jumped out from all the commentary we've seen on climate and the UN report. It said, among other things, when it comes to the centrist technocracy, which has been shaping our response to global warming in general, the article noted, it is not that the emperor is wearing no clothes, it's that his whole suit is on fire. Ajay Singh Chaudhary wrote the piece, and he joins us by phone. He's the executive director of the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. His book, In Progress, is on politics in the age of the Anthropocene, the man-made era. Ajay, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Christopher.
You said in that article that the goal of containing heat rise is, on its face, impossible. President Trump, oddly enough, says the same, but he's not bothered by it. Explain that.
Well, it's not that it's not possible. It's that the sort of, like, doing it within the systems that we have, right? So the most frequently gestured to is the, you know, Paris Climate Accords, which are sort of contradictory in and of themselves. They want to achieve this these stated targets of, you know, less than 1.5 and probably, you know, topping out around 2, but they want to do it with our existing social, economic, and political systems. And actually, a lot of what Dr. Najam just said, I would just agree with so much of it. I would spin it ever so slightly differently, though, and I'd emphasize some different things, which is that there's a word that it seems to be missing from these conversations, which is capitalism. It's not that humanity is, in fact, doing all these things. Humanity doesn't stand in the way of some of the mitigation and adaptation efforts that could be done. It's that we have a socioeconomic system that is predicated on the kind of extractive fuel sources and general extractive regimes, right? Whether we're talking about social systems, economic systems, and of course, fossil fuels and planetary boundaries that keep it going in the way that we know it.
You speak in your article of high carbon economic growth and profits too, of course. And I wonder if I'm hearing a definition of capitalism. in the modern world?
I mean, it's funny. In that same article, I get into this question of definitions just sort of obliquely at the end, because like the truth is there's a lot of things we could do, and I list a whole host of them in the article. There's a lot of things we could do, and whether or not what happens on the other side of that, and I tend to agree absolutely with Dr. Njam, what he was saying, that the problem is not the future. I cannot stress that enough, that we are living through this, you know, right now. And there's a lot that we can do, and whether what comes out of that, you know, what sort of springs forth, is capitalism, or we want to call it something else, post-capitalism, is it real socialism, like God knows, but it is so dramatically different than the socioeconomic order we have now, and it's fundamental to understand, and that's why it's sort of so hard to hear. And I think for many people, people who you know do propose these sort of small bore reforms, whether it be you know like having a cap and trade system or using market incentives, when in fact we know we need broad-based political transformation. And the other thing I would emphasize is, Dr. Njam was correct in saying that you know this will hit hardest areas that have contributed the least. But that's not just sort of an irony, right? It's as you said, it's not nature targeting people. The truth is, the same system that drives such extraordinary inequality in our world and such extraordinary imbalance of power between global north and global south also drive and support and are necessary for the maintenance of capitalism as we know it. Thus, if we're going to take climate change seriously, we have to take capitalism seriously.
You're talking about a world that capitalism created in some sense. But come back to the Trump question. The New York Times can't believe that he's not responded to this, and they think he's stupid, that he doesn't get it. But you point out that his very own task force on this problem estimated that by the end of this century, the heat rise will be not 1.5, it'll be 4 degrees centigrade. And this a way, I want you to explain it, in which he has incorporated this into his thinking about the world. You call it, and he might too, right-wing climate realism. Unpack that.
Sure, happy to. I do think that there's often a way in which we talk about these conversations, again, as if everyone's, like, the world is going to end, right? It's the apocalypse. Like, everyone's going to die. So this is it. We're all going to die, right? It's a quote from Douglas Adams. But the truth is, actually, there are a lot of people that won't. And we can sort of very easily imagine in our minds that the demographics, the wealth levels, the placement of the people that are actually going to do pretty well through this period. And I do sort of think there is a nascent, you know, whether Trump actually believes it or not, God knows. I'm not going to speculate about what he actually believes or not. But I do think there was something in that study that was so fascinating, because they were basically saying they were leaving that denialism behind. Oh, there's no such thing. Oh, it's a Chinese hoax. Oh, and going instead with, yep, it's going to happen and it's too late and there's nothing to do about it. And what's so fascinating to me there is, one, that is an honest statement, at least partially, right? They're saying the things that they were trying to overturn, these fuel efficiency standards. And the truth is, like just a couple fuel efficiency standards, that they're right. That's not going to turn the tide. They're right when they say business as usual, as the natural scientific literature often says, will lead to a 4 degree or more increase. Like if you do nothing, if you change nothing, that's what's going to happen. Those things are true, and I think this sets up something that, again, is sort of missing from this conversation, which is that it's a political conflict.
It's strange because a rising crisis is not going to be good for Trump's base. It may be good for his 10 best friends. They have their planes. They have their mountaintops. They have their Mar-a-Lagos. Although that's going to be pretty soggy for the first 5 floors. I want to throw it to you, Adil. Where does capitalism, in your view, figure among the obstacles to progress here or the elements of the problem?
I think the beliefs that come with the models that we have are a major part of the problem, in the sense that there is this belief in the gospel of growth and of continuous growth in a planet that is at very serious levels, not infinite. And everyone's growth, right? That's the thing, that everyone has to constantly grow. At some point, that's going to meet a wall, and that wall might be climate change. But different people will meet the wall differently. By my estimation, at least a billion people in the world today, 2018, at least a billion people in the world today live in what I call the age of adaptation. That they are no longer in a mitigating world where they have to do something to stop climate, they have to actually adapt to a climate that has changed for them, right? And that means that they have to take their resources and use them to adapt to this within that model. My only issue, my only question, I think, for Mr. Chaudhary, who I also agree with, is I am not as confident that climate will force us to change the model.
No.
Unfortunately, I think the model is stronger. And what we will do is,
you mean by
we will
the,
let
the sheer force of
fall.
Habit or privilege or these
because
the imbalance
yes,
of power,
yes, and inertia, and the because I don't see the will to make the type of changes that are needed.
What is the political change that could work toward your dream?
To me,
please.
Yes. I mean, truthfully, there's a lot that I agree with. I do think you can see a couple of things that could be hopeful for the political picture. And I will say that it's likely these are I don't even know if I'd go 50-50, which I think what Professor Reese said. You know, it could be even worse than that. But for example, I do think there's a growing awareness of these problems in the global north, which I think most people have noted is the sort of primary source of this problem.
Are you asking?
Do you think? Sorry, go ahead.
Are you asking, Ideal?
Oh no! I was just talking.
Okay.
Sorry, I.
No, but this question of what people talk about, just parenthetically here, and what part media plays. We spoke with Alan Rusbridger this week, a very brave former editor of The Guardian from London, and he dedicated his last years on the job to a campaign that was called Keep It in the Ground, meaning all the oil, gas, and coal, that if we burn it, it'll smother us for sure. It was a brilliant series of podcasts too, but it was water off the duck's back for most of the public. And he said, with a certain, I don't know, regret, embarrassment, that he had sort of turned to top director of the Bank of England, excuse me, but not BP, British Petroleum, forgive me, changed its advertising name briefly to Beyond Petroleum.
Right.
And the investors didn't like it. What's to do? How's to talk about it?
In some ways, I think what he's also referring to, I see this all over the world. A lot of people have become very comfortable talking about climate change because they've realized that talking about it does not mean doing something about it.
Right.
So it's become easier actually to accept it. The one other thought from what Ajay was saying was actually people in the global south have understood the reality of climate change even more.
Yeah.
So I've recently did this research with my colleague Hendrik Selin in Pakistan, and we literally couldn't find anyone who doubted climate change is humanly induced. And that is very odd coming from the U.S., where somehow we still think of it as a debate.
Yes. If I could just jump in and echo that. One of the things I think is so interesting in this sort of story is that it is so widespread amongst especially many political movements and in many spaces in the global south that this is not only an unquestionable sort of issue, but like an unquestionable crisis, if not the crisis, the most important one. And I think that part of the political challenge is A, starting to be comfortable, which a lot of these newer, a lot of the most Actually, it's not, I agree with, again, Dr. Najamba, you know, the reports aren't that different over the years, but they have been getting a little bit more sanguine, as I say in the article, that some of these socioeconomic issues are really quite central, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a technical problem. And I think as we're trying to build a sort of political, and right, if there's going to be a change on that, it's going to be political. I think part of the case that's going to have to be made, and I think you can make it, is that a lot of what is hurt, a lot of what is damaging, right, for the sort of self-interest, like rational self-interest of many, many people in the global north, is also issues that are driving climate change for everyone. So there's actually some possible and some hopeful political bonds and internationalism that can be built for this. Is that easy? No. Is it even likely? I hope so. But it is possible, and I think the case can be made that it is in so many people's interests, as opposed to, you know, you have Mar-a-Lago might go down, sure. But, you know, there could be a nice backup, you know, luxury compound in Montana. You know, there is a sort of grim reality to the sort of right-wing climate realism.
Ajay, give us a scoop on your research here. What would make the Anthropocene sustainable, this man-shaped planet?
Oh, I wish I had, it's funny, I don't have my article in front of me. I listed like 13 different things. And those are all just sort of like policy ideas or policy like portfolios of in which other people could be doing stuff. And actually, I think the bigger issues are how to build these political coalitions, how to have states and institutions and movements that could sustain them. Those are actually the really tough questions. But in terms of like actual stuff, obviously, we have to have a rapid, enforced transition to renewables, concomitant, right? We can't just add renewables, concomitant with, as you were saying, keep it in the ground, removing fossil fuels. We need a massive transfer of resources, whether that be technology, wealth, all kinds of things, from the global north to the global south, as most everyone here has noted. While the Global North has to essentially become, there's a wonderful phrase from Kate Raworth, who used to be the head of Oxfam, you know, sort of growth agnostic. There will be bits where we'll grow, and there's going to be bits, frankly, where we degrow. But there needs to be space for Global South countries to develop and hopefully develop with clean technology. And that's something that I think a lot of these movements are very, very interested in. But you can go down a whole host of these issues. You know, we have built international institutions for the free flow of capital. This has done very little for us. You know, people like to talk about, you know, these things. We have built almost the perfect opposite world to deal with this problem.
Ajay, I wonder, do you have a candidate, a Gandhi-esque candidate from the third world to lead us, to teach us, to show us an example?
That's difficult. I'm not a big like savior figure kind of guy. But I will.
No, obviously it's going to take a century and thousands, millions of great strokes. But give us a model.
Faster than that. I can't choose a savior figure. But what I will say is this: when I look at a place like Kerala in India, is a place that used to have. You know, and it's a really interesting story that your listeners can look.
I've been there. The most successful communist government in the world.
Exactly.
Maybe the only one.
Communist in power, running a technically capitalist system. Very, very low income, but tremendous human development outcomes. And then, if you follow that history, of course, it's not in a vacuum, right? As India opens up, Kerala becomes subject to globalized forces. Now that's. Both has good and bad sides. But, of course, as India becomes much more right-wing and much more authoritarian, Kerala has much more difficulties. There's financialized corporations. And then, of course, Kerala, just this past summer, hit with sort of historic levels of flooding. And this, to me, is the story of sort of the Anthropocene as we know it. And there's a footnote.
Ajay, hold it there. We've got to let Adil give us a vision.
So,
and maybe a hero or a model.
I'll tell you who my hero is. My hero is the shrimp farmer in Bangladesh, the rickshaw driver in Mumbai, the wheat farmer in Sindh in Pakistan, because they are now the front line of mm-hmm. climate change. It is no longer scientists and scholars like myself, or it is those are the people. Here is the thing I would like to highlight. We are still talking about climate as if it is something that we need to stop. Yes, we need to stop it. But let us also start thinking about not how climate change will be stopped, but what will we do when it happens, because it is happening. And that's what that rickshaw driver is doing in the age of adaptation. And in the age of adaptation, we will be talking as much about water as we have been talking about energy, because water is at the forefront of dealing with climate change.
We're going to do this program every week from now on and save the planet. Thank you, Adil Najam and Ajay Singh Chaudhary. Thanks also to our royal astronomer, Martin Rees. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Rebecca Panofka, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our Mother Earth. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source.